You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. With an uncertain path forward on dealing with mold issues in City Hall, the Garibaldi City Council has pushed for a temporary home. At a meeting at the end of April, councilors asked City Manager Jake Boone to begin preparations to rent a 40-foot trailer to house city staff. Garibaldi City Hall has been closed since the end of January, after employees' concerns about mold were confirmed in several areas. Boone says the remediation project will likely be expensive. One company has already provided an estimate of $78,000. Staff is still soliciting additional bids, hoping to find ways to minimize the cost of repairs and work it into next year's budget. A special meeting is scheduled for May 11th. Garibaldi's financial situation is not ideal. An audit of the 2022-2023 fiscal year shows city staff at the time had overestimated revenues and underestimated expenses, budgeting and spending based on anticipated grants that were either not awarded or not even applied for. The general fund and public safety reserve funds were in the negative that fiscal year, according to the audit. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald. Online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Oregon could lift strict rules that effectively ban canola crops in central Oregon. As OPB's Alejandro Figueroa reports, some farm groups worry about what this change might mean on the west side of the Cascade Mountains.
These rules cover all of Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes counties. Some farmers there say they need more options as they deal with less water. They say canola, grown for its oil, is a good alternative. And while this isn't as strongly debated in Central Oregon, some farm groups say these changes could set a precedent for the Willamette Valley, where growers have long worried about canola. That crop is a notorious cross-pollinator with similar plant species like mustards or broccoli. Alice Morrison is with Friends of Family Farmers.
We are very concerned about this because of the potential to destabilize the trust that seed companies the world over have in this region.
Regulators expect to adopt the Central Oregon rules by late summer.
That was Alejandro Figueroa reporting. Snowpack levels continue to drop as Oregon copes with the aftermath of its warmest winter in 90 years. KLCC's Zach Ziegler reports conditions might be worse than normal this summer.
Six more Oregon counties received drought declarations from the state, bringing the total to 9 this year. Requests are pending in 3 more. Water Resources Department hydrologist Cameron Greenwood says snowpack levels haven't been this bad heading into the summer since 2015.
Which led to some of the worst drought we've seen in Oregon, with 25 of 36 counties receiving state drought declarations by the end of that water year. So if that's any indicator of how conditions can develop for us, we're in for a pretty tough summer with respect to water supply conditions.
Greenwood says conditions could mean earlier regulation for water users, smaller allotments in irrigation districts, and possible long-term consequences for groundwater users. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
With a little over a month left in the school year, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has announced what districts are receiving a share of the state's summer learning money. But as Elizabeth Miller reports, some school districts who received thousands of dollars last year didn't get anything this year.
The Reynolds School District in East Multnomah County serves a diverse group of students. Over half of students there are experiencing poverty. Last year, the district received $1 million in state summer money. It supported programs for over 1,000 students. Reynolds didn't receive any money for this summer. Superintendent Frank Carapello says they can't afford the programs without state help.
At this point, we are facing a $21 million budget deficit going into the next school year, so we don't have other sources of funds. We were counting on these summer funds to provide summer programs.
Carapello says he hopes the state reconsiders. The grants are on a two-year cycle, so districts that missed out may have to wait until 2028 for another shot. Elizabeth Miller reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Turning now to news from Washington State. Results from the State Health Department's 2025 Healthy Youth Survey were just released. They show modest improvements in well-being for Washington's young people. KNKX's Anna Marie Yanni has more.
The survey has been conducted every 2 years since 2002, skipping the pandemic. Thousands of Washington students between grades 6 and 12 are asked questions about their health and environment. Sarah Mariani is with the State Healthcare Authority. Her focus is on substance use and mental health.
There have been instances where youth mental health has worsened. Right now, we're really happy to report that mental health is improving, and we see that in the data.
For example, reported anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation are trending downwards.
6 in 10 of the 10th graders reported having an adult that they can turn to when they feel sad or hopeless.
The 2025 survey also found drug use among Washington youth remains low. I'm Anna Marie Yanni reporting.
This is the week when candidates must sign up in order to run for office in Washington state. That deadline is heating up the court battle over appropriate qualifications for sheriff candidates. Amy Radel has more.
A Thurston County Superior Court judge ruled to pause new regulations on who can run for county sheriff in the state. The law would have required candidates for sheriff to be certified by a commission first, undergo a background check, and have 5 years of law enforcement experience. Judge Christine Schaller said the law is unconstitutional and holds sheriffs to different standards than other elected officials. Four sheriffs brought the initial lawsuit against the state, saying the new rules would bar them from running for re-election. Supporters of the law say it would hold sheriffs to the same standards as police chiefs. The state is expected to submit an appeal to the Supreme Court. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Last week, the city of Seattle opened its first ever warehouse dedicated to salvaging and reusing old lumber. The warehouse is being paid for by a federal grant. KUOW's Ida Massoud has that story.
These are actually the joists out of the Aberdeen Armory.
That's Aaron Blanchard from Earthwise Architectural Salvage. The company runs the new warehouse in Seattle's Soto neighborhood. It's full of piles of old wood, mostly Douglas fir, from buildings that are being renovated or demolished.
This is the heritage lumber that we are obsessed with around here. This is the stuff that was the original forests that were here when people first started settling Seattle. And it's just very important because it is a finite resource to make sure that it can be reclaimed and reused.
This warehouse is being paid for by a $4 million grant from the EPA to the city of Seattle. The money comes from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law from 2021 and is meant to help Seattle reduce the amount of old lumber that gets thrown away or burned. The grant will pay for the setup and first 3 years of operation of the warehouse. After that, the company anticipates it will be self-sustaining. I'm Ida Massoud, reporting.
Officials in Snohomish County are seeking emergency permission to fix a crumbling levee near the city of Stanwood. The century-old structure protects the city and nearby farmland from the waters of Skagit Bay. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
If that levee were to fail, 1,100 people in the Stanwood area could be displaced. City Hall, a police station, three schools, and three nursing homes could flood with seawater. Tyler Brem knows the levee as well as anyone. He farms potatoes and seed crops just behind it.
Everything behind us is underwater if something happens to this levee that you're standing on. As you can see, this is the narrowest part. It's a couple feet wide on top, to be generous.
He's been pushing for the levee to be improved for more than 15 years. Much of it is eroding and vulnerable to leaks or outright failure.
I mean, this was built back in the 1920s, and to our knowledge, it wasn't built to any standard, and it was built by using material just found here on site.
Stanwood's situation got more urgent in January. That's when a group of duck hunters noticed a high tide overtopping the levee for several hours as waves hit from the west. When the tide retreated, it revealed a half-mile stretch of the levee had been badly eroded.
Once that happens on a levee, once you get overtopping, the levee eats away quickly.
Alan Litton is Stanwood's city engineer. He and other officials say the levee might not survive another winter and the highest tides of the year, known as king tides.
Unfortunately, the levee is in such poor condition after that king tide that we don't think we'll be able to wait a year, 2 year, 3 year, however long these permits are going to take to have in hand.
The Stanwood levee separates farmland from tidelands. Tidal marshes are critical nurseries for Chinook salmon, which are protected under the Endangered Species Act. 2 years ago, federal agencies started requiring construction in salmon habitat to try to undo the decades of habitat loss that have landed salmon in deep trouble. Projects like Stanwood stalled as they had to be redesigned to do more for salmon. The Stillaguamish tribe has been collaborating with the city to try to fix the muddy berm that makes the city of Stanwood possible.
So we've been scrambling.
Jason Griffith is the tribe's environmental manager. Tribes around Puget Sound are less known for repairing levees than trying to remove them to help salmon. But Griffith says for this project, the Stillaguamish tribe is willing to pursue construction without helping salmon. The tribe is mostly trying to be a good neighbor.
A lot of the tribal members are residents in this area and shop in the businesses in Stanwood and that sort of thing.
Griffith says he feels personally responsible to get construction going and not let a flood devastate Stanwood.
I would be lying if I said it didn't keep me up some nights.
The city and the tribe hope to get permission from the Army Corps of Engineers for emergency repairs this summer. That's when the surrounding farmland is dry enough for heavy equipment to drive up to the levee without getting stuck in the mud. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Last week, a march and rally happened in Seattle on May Day. On hand was the Seattle Singing Resistance. They're a new group inspired by the anti-ICE movement in Minnesota. As Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports, they're just one example of how Minnesota-style organizing is influencing the Pacific Northwest.
You do not carry this all alone.
Bex Lips and Jake Harris are longtime singing activists. 2 months ago, they helped found the Seattle Singing Resistance.
Singing Resistance Minneapolis was already doing their thing, and then they put out a call to organizers all over the country to come together and organize under this Singing Resistance umbrella. So we looked at each other and we were like, well, I guess we are Singing Resistance now.
This winter, the federal government deployed more than 3,000 ICE and Border Patrol agents to Minnesota. Thousands were arrested and 2 U.S. citizens killed. Many say the protests were instrumental in getting the administration to eventually draw down. The Minnesotans' tactics were big and diverse, from physically blocking immigration arrests to delivering food to immigrant families, and even serenading ICE agents. Singing, "It's Okay to Change Your Mind." That's an original song from Minnesota. But the sound you're hearing is actually from Seattle, when the Seattle Singing Resistance gathered outside Target in Northgate, part of a national campaign pressuring the company to block ICE from its stores. Organizers Bex Lips and Jake Harris were there too. They say singing together is a simple yet powerful tool to spread your message, sure, but even more to bring people together.
You embody that message collectively together for one moment and go, yeah, we all agree with that. You walk away from that interaction a lot different than if you just said, yeah, we hate this thing and we hate this thing.
Outside Washington Hall in central Seattle, Sadiq Daniels hands out flyers for a protest. He didn't used to be politically active until federal agents killed Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, and U.S. officials justified the shootings.
You can't just lie to the people and backtrack it later, especially after a murder of an American citizen.
He's part of a wave of people who were motivated by what they saw.
If the government's goal was to go to Minneapolis, arrest people, take that plan, and just apply it to the rest of the country, they're going to be here at some point.
That's why Daniels came out today, along with more than 100 people. They packed into a warm room, taking notes and listening intently to activists from Minnesota.
We started out in Tucson, then we went to Los Angeles.
Seattle was the last stop on a multi-city tour. Murray was a presenter. Just one name for him, he says, so he doesn't get doxxed. He and 3 others shared their stories and tips.
What's your message that you want people to take away? Well, I think number one is, like, you really need to get these infrastructures set up before shit gets real, so to speak.
He's talking about neighborhood-specific infrastructure, like patrols tracking federal agents and rapid response networks. Those include signal group chats to alert people when ICE is nearby. Cam is another presenter from Minneapolis.
It's given us the ability to respond to ICE abductions within minutes. And as we discussed in the talk, it overshadowed the centralized nonprofit hotlines that quickly became outmoded as ICE became more aggressive with their tactics.
Some protest tactics were aggressive, too, and sometimes controversial, like blowing whistles or getting physically violent with ICE. And not everybody was on board with that. Here in the Seattle area, many people have already spent months figuring out their strategy for any potential ICE surge, including setting up their own neighborhood networks to spot and respond to immigration enforcement. They're adopting, but also adapting, tactics from Minnesota. Community involvement, of course, is not new to the Pacific Northwest. The activists from Minnesota say they also came to learn from us. In Seattle, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
A dock at a popular lake in Ilwaco in Pacific County keeps on becoming detached. At a recent meeting, the Ilwaco City Council voted to approve more than $8,000 in estimated costs to purchase a new floating dock for Black Lake from the Port of Peninsula. The port builds its own dock sections on site and will be able to deliver a new 33-foot-long dock. The move comes after it was discovered in March that the dock at Black Lake, located on the east side of the lake, had come loose from one of the anchor points and partly floated away into the shoreline. The dock was ultimately pulled from Black Lake because City Public Works employees had run out of points where its tethers could be securely reconnected. The city estimates it could take approximately 4 to 6 weeks to work through the necessary shoreline permitting and environmental impact analysis before the dock can be installed. The city plans to pull funding from either the city's general or tourism funds. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. That includes news host and production assistant Ava Berardi, and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. You can find more local and regional news at kmun.org/news.
Coming up next, the American Democracy Minute. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The April 29th U.S. Supreme Court decision in Louisiana versus Calais has unleashed a torrent of last-minute gerrymandering and escalated the redistricting arms race in both red and blue states. The decision could result in 7 or more GOP U.S. House seats, not counting the 4 seats just gerrymandered in Florida. President Donald Trump initiated the redistricting war in Texas last year, hoping to lock in safe Republican seats in the face of expected losses in November. With early primary voting beginning May 2nd, Louisiana immediately suspended only congressional voting, but has yet to announce a special session to redistrict after the court struck down its majority-minority districts, the state's only Democratic congressional seats. May 1st, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey called a special session which will likely eliminate its 2 majority-minority districts, also the only Democratic seats. A special session in Tennessee is likely to eliminate 1 blue district in Memphis, and South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster signaled that the state is likely to redistrict, flipping 1 Democratic seat. Mississippi's legislature is also preparing to eliminate 1 blue congressional seat. In response, liberal-leaning states which had considered redistricting but took no action may rekindle those fires. More on that in an upcoming report. We've linked to the local reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.